Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are, and welcome to the Politics Guys with your hosts, Jay Parson and Michael Baranowski.
Welcome to the Politics Guys. I'm Michael Baranowski, a political scientist at Northern Kentucky University. My guest today is Jeremy Hale, co-author of The Indivisible Guide, a practical guide to influencing members of Congress, written by a team of former congressional staffers. From 2008 to 2012, Jeremy served as a legislative aide to Representative Lloyd Doggett, along with Indivisible board members Ezra Levin and Sarah Dole. Since then, Jeremy has worked in criminal justice reform advocacy at the Sentencing Project and as a public interest lawyer in San Francisco. His writing has appeared in numerous national publications and outlets, including the New York Times, Los Angeles Times, the Washington Post, and NPR's All Things Considered. Jeremy Hale, welcome to the show.
Hey, Mike. Good to be with you.
You know, I'd like to start by talking a little bit about your background. For 4 years, you were a legislative aide to a member of Congress, and I'm wondering, what exactly does that job involve?
Sure. Well, I was a legislative assistant or legislative counsel, which basically means that I handled a portfolio of different policy areas, so judiciary, banking, trade, and so on. So I met with constituents, tracked mail, advised the congressmen on votes, drafted legislation. I guess that's the answer you would expect. But working in a congressional office is often unpredictable. So whether you're the senior legislative staffer or a junior aide, you could be asked at any time to take a meeting or draft a speech or run a document to a hearing room. I remember on my very first day as an intern, I met with lawyers for a famous Russian political prisoner. I'm not sure they were thrilled to be meeting with me.
Right.
But I think responsibility is spread out, both because it's efficient and because it keeps information and power, especially diffuse throughout the office.
So after those 4 years, I'm sure that there are some things that you learned, both positive and negative, probably about how Congress operates that a person wouldn't pick up necessarily in a book or a political science text or political science class or something. So I was wondering, does anything spring to mind as things that were particularly surprising, either good or bad?
Yeah, I think one of the most important lessons that I learned was that members of Congress actually are very responsive to constituents. And that's because for every member, the top priority is winning re-election. And that's not to say they don't have political convictions. I think most of them do. But every one of them believes that if they're not re-elected, their good intentions are irrelevant. In order to carry forward their agenda, they have to maintain power. So they're obsessed with what's happening in their district and states. They're extremely sensitive to anything that might harm their public image. When they show up to a ribbon cutting, they want the headline to be that they helped their district build a bridge. What they don't want is coverage of a dozen angry constituents showing up and asking why they're cutting deals with a corrupt administration. So that means that constituents actually have a lot of power.
So, I recently talked on the show to congressional scholar Norm Ornstein, and he's been arguing actually for a while now that Congress has become sort of a deeply dysfunctional place. And you had sort of an inside look at it for a number of years. And I was wondering, is that your take on it as well?
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, I think it's a combination of things. The first thing I would point to is gerrymandering, which has given most members of Congress very safe seats. And if they're threatened at all, it's usually a primary challenge. So I think that they play to their base. Rather than trying to win over voters from the other side. I think another big factor is the rise of fake news, which makes it almost impossible for voters to hold their members of Congress accountable. And it doesn't help that I think one of our two major political parties doesn't particularly like government, doesn't particularly believe in government, and actually benefits from congressional dysfunction. I think it reinforces their message that government doesn't work.
Mm-hmm. So what led you to move on from your job at Capitol Hill and to found the Indivisible Project?
So I went from Capitol Hill to the Sentencing Project, which is a criminal justice reform think tank in Washington. I worked for 4 years trying to get sentencing reform legislation through Congress. I left D.C. 8 months ago because I was tired of Congress, wanted a break, wanted to get off Twitter. But just when I thought I was out, right, they pulled me back in. You know, after the election, a lot of us were shocked and angry and sad. And a group of former Democratic congressional staffers began having the same conversation that everyone was having, which was, what do we do now? We saw a lot of energy out there, people coming together on Facebook groups in their living rooms, trying to figure out what to do. Outside my building here in San Francisco, there were nightly marches down Market Street. So we saw all this energy, but we didn't think it was being channeled in a way that would make a real difference. And so that's sort of what prompted the Indivisible Guide. It sort of hit us that we've seen a model of success before, and that was, as congressional staffers, we saw the Tea Party come together and be able to stop President Obama's agenda.
Now, did you ever expect it to become as popular as it is? I mean, it seems like the Indivisible Guide has really sort of exploded in the months since you founded it.
No, I mean, it's amazing. I mean, the project was born, I think, a few days after Thanksgiving, when my pal from the Doggett office, Ezra Levin, and his wife, Leah, were sitting in a bar in Austin, Texas, and they came up with the idea to put together a guide, again, taking lessons from the Tea Party. I think it was Leah who came up with the name Indivisible. You know, they circulated a rough draft to a group of former congressional staffers, and we worked on it and, you know, posted it as a Google Doc, sent it around to friends and family. And the next morning, my buddy emailed me and said, "You broke Google." So many folks were trying to download it that Google crashed.
Yeah.
So that was sort of the beginning.
Now I've read through the guide, and right away from the introduction, I mean, you guys don't pull any punches in it. You refer to President Trump as a racist, corrupt, authoritarian, petty tyrant. Strong words, obviously. And so I'm wondering, do you believe that Donald Trump is a serious, legitimate threat to democracy in America?
I do. I mean, Donald Trump campaigned on building a wall to keep out Mexicans, on instituting nationwide stop and frisk, on banning people of the Islamic faith, you know, used his campaign to increase his personal net worth. And now he's trying to remake the country in his own image, using a mandate that he doesn't have. And the people who are going to be victimized by Trump's agenda are among the most vulnerable members of our society. They're Muslims and refugees, people of color, people with disabilities, elderly, the sick, the poor, the young. So given what's at stake, we think that we have a moral obligation to use every tool in our toolbox to protect our friends and neighbors and ourselves. And also, it sounds maybe strong to say this, but we think we have a moral responsibility to stop Trump in order to save our democracy.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned the Tea Party a few times, and clearly you don't share the values of the Tea Party, but in the guide, you argue that there are some things that the Tea Party movement can teach the left. There are some really valuable lessons there. And I'm wondering, what are some of those key lessons in your mind?
Well, that's right. We take our inspiration from the Tea Party, not because we agree with their policies or their sometimes nasty behavior. But we think they got it right in terms of strategy and tactics. So a strategy that's focused on your home turf at the local level, focusing on your members of Congress, a strategy that's defensive. That's the real source of constituent power. If you want to resist Trump's agenda, you focus locally, you focus defensively, and you never give an inch. And that's what we learned from the Tea Party.
Now, you also point out, though, that there are some Tea Party tactics that you felt were effective, but you actually urge progressive activists not to emulate. And so what are the things that they did that, while they might have worked, you don't think are good ideas?
That's right. We don't agree with all the Tea Party tactics. There was an innuendo of racism and an occasional hint of violence. And we at Indivisible believe in progressive values of inclusion, respect, fairness, nonviolence. And so we believe that Indivisible groups should model these values at all times in their actions. And we think that's both the right thing to do and the smart thing to do in terms of strategy.
Now, in terms of more, I guess, in terms of strategy, you talk about stopping the Trump agenda. And there are a number of progressives I know that don't like this idea of becoming sort of the new party of no and think that, well, we should be pushing more of an alternative, positive policy agenda instead of just playing defense. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are on that.
Right. Well, standing in opposition is not about abandoning a positive vision for the future. We think progressives should continue working to develop policy ideas that can be enacted when we retake power. But for the next 2 years, at least, we're not going to be setting the agenda. Our power is not in agenda setting, but in responding to the agenda. So that's another lesson we learned from the Tea Party. They realized early on that if they tried to choose among competing conservative priorities, that their coalition would fracture. So rather than putting forward plans to stimulate the economy or to improve the healthcare system, they decided to just say no. So the Tea Party kept its movement strong and unified by standing in opposition. So we think that at least at the federal level and responding to Trump, that progressives need to do that today.
Now, in terms of communicating with members of Congress, our viewpoints, I've heard a lot of times that the most effective form of communication is a handwritten, old-style snail mail letter, and that a lot of electronic communication, particularly those online form letters where you kind of click to send a pre-written thing to your member, that those aren't really taken very seriously. Is that right?
I think it is. A good rule of thumb is the more difficult and time-consuming the action is, the more impact it will have. Because the member of Congress will know that you really, really care about the issue you're talking about. So the easiest thing to do is to sign an online petition or to click a button to send an email. That's also going to have the least amount of impact. The hardest thing to do is to get a big group of your friends out to a public event. So if you're able to do that, that's really going to send a message. The best thing you can do is show up in person at town halls, public events, and district meetings. Calls are good, too, but it's good to have them coordinated. So, again, gathering your friends and, you know, waiting for an opportune moment when something's happening in Congress and calling together and sort of flooding those offices with calls, that's what's going to make a difference.
So I wanted to ask you actually about town halls. I always wondered if they're just kind of window dressing, something members feel like, well, I guess I have to do this, or if they can actually, if what a member hears at a town hall, do you think can really change their behavior?
Yes, town halls matter tremendously. And I'll just give you one big example. For 7 years, Republicans promised that repealing the Obamacare would be the very first thing they did once they got in power. They passed dozens of repeal bills. Now they have the House, the Senate, and the presidency. And they promised on the first day of Trump's presidency that they would repeal it. And that didn't happen. Well, why? It's because in Arkansas and Illinois, New Jersey, and in states all across the country, constituents showed up at televised town halls and held their members of Congress accountable. They stood up. They said, I'm a constituent. I will be affected. My family will be affected if you repeal this Obamacare without a sound replacement. And they were able to change the narrative, through that action and through the media publicizing those town hall events. They were actually able to make Obamacare popular again. And they made members of Congress think twice about siding with Trump over their own constituents. Mitch McConnell just said this week that where we are on Obamacare at the moment is where Democrats want us to be. And, you know, we think that that's because of the organizing that we've seen on the ground and, you know, individual constituents taking action.
Well, how about people in states that are, you know, really conservative, say, you know, Alabama or Kentucky? I mean, in both those states, Trump absolutely trounced Clinton, or even, you know, a district in a competitive state. For instance, take me, for example. I'm in Ohio House District 1. And while Ohio, you know, nationally mm-hmm. was competitive, my representative, Steve Chabot, beat his Democratic challenger by almost 20 points. And so I got to wonder, with that huge of a cushion, does Steve Chabot really care what a liberal like me has to say? Can I really make a difference to his decision-making process?
I think you can. And we have several examples, again, from the healthcare debate. A few weeks ago, Congressman Mo Brooks, a conservative Republican from Alabama, told CNN that he didn't think that Republicans were going to be able to repeal Obamacare because of all the protests from constituents. Tom Cotton, very conservative senator from Arkansas, was confronted by more than 2,000 constituents at a town hall. A woman with a deep Southern accent saying, "Why do you want to take away my health care? You know, if you do, my family is going to die." And that made both, the local news, most importantly, also national news. And within a few days, Tom Cotton was saying that Republicans needed to slow down and make sure that they got it right in terms of health care. I mean, that's the biggest example. There's a smaller example, too. So on the very first day of the Congress, Republicans were trying to gut the congressional office. That's a bad idea. If anything, we need more ethics in Congress, not less. But it turns out that constituents thought that too. They called Congress. They went to their district offices. The Indivisible Roanoke Group went to Congressman Goodlatte's office. He was the one offering the legislation. He's a conservative Republican from Roanoke. They gave his district director saran wrap saying, "You've got to be transparent." They recorded it on video and, it made the news, and Congressman Goodlatte withdrew the amendment. And there was reporting that, members of Congress said they did that. They had to back off because of constituent power. So, this is happening. It's not just happening in moderate districts and states. It's also happening in, the reddest and most conservative of places.
Right. So you're saying essentially that it's not the case that just because you're a conservative in a liberal district or vice versa, obviously works both ways, that your member is not going to listen to you if you organize and do something kind of effective, especially if it gets media attention, basically.
Right. And, the experience goes back to, again, when I was working in Congress for Congressman Lloyd Doggett. He was one of the first members of Congress really targeted by the Tea Party. He held a town hall in Austin at a local grocery store that August of 2009. These are usually low-key affairs. And he was mobbed by dozens of angry constituents carrying "Don't Tread on Me" battle flags and, denouncing socialized health care. And that scene was captured on videos, looped endlessly on cable news. And, Congressman Doggett wasn't about to change his position. He's a strong progressive. But the Democrats weren't the only audience. Republicans were. And the message to Republicans was that standing up to Obama would be rewarded and compromise would be punished. So, just as these town halls are targeting Republicans now, they're also sending a message to Democrats, even liberal Democrats, not to compromise with the Trump administration.
Right. So what about people who live in districts or states that are already represented by strong progressives? I mean, for instance, let's say you're living in San Francisco. I mean, is your time, your energy better spent trying to influence legislators from other districts and states who are maybe a little more in play or since your representatives are already kind of, fighting the good fight, as it were?
Yeah, I think, we have the Indivisible Guide, covers this issue. What happens if you have a good member of Congress? And we say, first of all, thank them. Members of Congress respond to positive feedback. But also, there are examples of even liberal members of Congress and senators moving as a result of activism in the last few months. One example, when Donald Trump put forward Mike Pompeo to lead the CIA. 15 Democrats voted for him, even though, he's a person who had slandered Muslim Americans. He's open to torture. He condoned widespread surveillance of Americans. A few days later, constituents rallied outside of, Senator Feinstein's office here in California, chanting, "Why Pompeo? Why Pompeo?" And they did it outside of Chuck Schumer's office in New York and Senator Klobuchar's office in Minnesota and elsewhere. 2 weeks later, zero Democrats voted for Trump's pick to run the Department of Education. Betsy DeVos. You know, she's not that far to the right of Mike Pompeo. She hasn't endorsed torture, at least that we know of. So the difference in those two votes is that constituents showed up and made their voices heard. And those were liberal Democrats in Congress. And the other part of your question, I would say, no, you know, it's not a good use of your time to switch. If you think your member of Congress is good, to switch to other districts or other members outside your state. And, you know, we also talk about this in our guide. Those members of Congress don't represent you. They don't care what you say. And we saw this, you know, as congressional staffers, when calls would come in from across the country, Tea Party groups, you know, those, you know, staffers are going to, or interns are going to listen politely. They may even write down what you say, but it's not going to make an impact, in that office. Unless you live in the first district of Wisconsin, calling Paul Ryan's office, and saying you're upset about, you know, healthcare is not going to make an impact.
Right. So you've mentioned already before that, organized groups can have more of an impact than individuals even. And so I know you talk about this in the guide as well, but what's just in general your advice for people who want to try to band together to have a greater impact? I mean, what sort of things have you found to be particularly successful along those lines?
Right. So, you know, after the guide was released and there was all this interest, we added to our website a function where you can go there and sort of you can find other people in your community who are like-minded and who want to organize. And, you know, since that time, 6,000 indivisible groups have registered through our website. There's now at least two indivisible groups in every congressional district. And so these groups are they're meeting, and we have tools on our website about, you know, how to have a meeting, how to decide on an action to take. And, you know, they share, you know, on Twitter and by emailing us their, you know, photos and videos and stories of their actions. And it's just been tremendous. These groups are taking action, you know, in every corner of the country. So I think, you know, finding like-minded people to join together, creates a sense of camaraderie and energy. And yeah, certainly, you know, like I said earlier, if you're able to get a group of people speaking to Congress with a unified voice to your member of Congress in your district, that's going to have more of an impact than just sort of an individual person, you know, sending a letter.
Sure. So you mentioned changing a few things in the guide and so forth. I was hoping you could talk about that a little bit. I know it's been through a number of iterations, and so I'm wondering what have the main changes been since it's first come out, and where do you see the guide and the movement, for that matter, going from here?
Right. Well, the guide itself, you know, it was filled with typos when it first came out, so we've cleaned up some of those. The original guide is fairly intact, but what we've done is we've added toolkits that go deeper on some of the issues. So, you know, how to start an indivisible group, how to hold a meeting, what to do when you go to a town hall. Then we also have, you know, we've added to our website, we have scripts on individual issues. So when you call your member of Congress to ask them not to repeal the Affordable Care Act or to vote against cloture on the extremist Supreme Court nomination, you know, what to say to those members' offices when they answer, and sort of anticipating what their answers are going to be and how to respond. So there, we really have a sort of wealth of materials that, you know, is going to continue. We're going to continue to add to, and you know, as we get into, you know, budget season you know, other issues, there's going to be tax cuts for the top, you know, 1%, we're sure where those are coming. And there are going to be other threats that we can't anticipate. Sure. So in terms of where we see the movement going, you know, we feel like we were able to really make a difference in saving the Affordable Care Act. We think that will make the difference in millions of lives, literally. We know that, you know, that's just one battle, and there are going to be other battles to come. So, preparing for those future fights, and also where it's not lost on us that there's more than one way to change Congress. One is to persuade members of Congress through pressure to change their positions. Another way is to change out the members of Congress themselves. So make sure that all this energy that we're seeing at town halls, that it makes a difference at the ballot box in 2018.
Right. You know, I wanted to ask you actually about 2018, because in the guide you mentioned that Donald Trump and the Republicans have control for the next 2 years. But, you know, given how safe the vast majority of House seats are, and also the fact in the Senate that in the 2018 elections, I think Democrats are defending something like 25 seats to 8 for the Republicans. I mean, it seems likely to me that we might actually be in for 4 years of Republican control, as depressing as that is to myself and other progressives, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm. Well, we think that the House is really up for grabs next year.
Really?
There will be a key test coming up here in a few weeks in the 6th District of Georgia. John Ossoff is running for the seat vacated by Tom Price, Donald Trump's Secretary of Health and Human Services in Georgia. That's a seat that's been held by Republicans for decades. But Donald Trump only won that district by a point or two in November. And John Ossoff, this a young Democrat progressive who's running there, has a real shot. There was a piece in the New York Times this morning, I think, about Republicans being worried that race is going to be closer than they anticipated. In the wider Congress, a couple dozen Republicans represent districts that Hillary won in 2016. So we see all of those districts as vulnerable for Republicans. I mean, in 2010, when I was working on Capitol Hill, and in 2009, when President Obama came into office, most analysts thought that Democrats were going to hold power in Congress for the foreseeable future. And then a wave started building in 2009 and 2010, and it crashed, and Republicans swept back the power in the House. So these things are not as predictable as they may seem now. I agree with you. The Senate is tough, but looking at the House, we really do think that Democrats have a chance to take it back next year. The question will be whether progressives can maintain this momentum. Turn the energy around opposing Trump into organizing and political action.
Right, which has always been kind of one of the problems for progressives, is turnout in midterm elections has generally been less than we would like, certainly. And my hope, and I'm sure your hope, is that changes in 2018.
Yeah, well, one thing we're seeing with Indivisible and really across the country in the progressive ecosystem is people coming out and getting involved in politics who say that they were never involved before. Those are the kind of things we heard in 2009, 2010. And if that's happening, that really changes the equation. If it's really true that Donald Trump has energized and activated a progressive energy in this country, that would be the one silver lining from what otherwise has been a very dark few months for our country.
Right. And I should mention, while the Politics Guys, we're a bipartisan podcast, pretty clearly both you and I are certainly no fans of President Trump and Republicans in Congress. But it occurred to me when reading through the Indivisible Guide that really this is a sort of a bipartisan blueprint, in the sense that that whether you're a conservative or a liberal or what have you, if you want your voice to be more effectively heard, there are a ton of lessons in this guide, regardless of your ideology.
That's exactly right. So the Indivisible Guide is about how individual constituents focusing on their own members of Congress can come together to resist an administration. And it's based on that basic understanding of how democracy works, which applies whether it's a Democrat or a Republican in the White House, which is that in this case, Donald Trump's agenda doesn't just depend on Donald Trump. It depends on individual members of Congress enacting that agenda, going along with it or resisting it. That's because every member of Congress wakes up in the morning thinking, how am I going to get reelected? So that gives constituents a lot of power, whether it's a Republican in the White House, a Democrat, whether their members are you know, on regardless of which party their members of Congress are. These principles apply for everyone.
Yeah, sure. You know, I know we're kind of running a little short on time, but there's one final question I like to ask. I try to ask pretty much everyone who comes on the show. You're obviously, you know, very deeply involved and deeply knowledgeable about politics and policy. And so I was wondering what resources, I mean, aside from the Invisible Guide, of course, you know, it could be books, apps, websites, podcasts, documentaries, what have you. What would you recommend to people who would like to be better informed, more deeply knowledgeable about this stuff?
Yeah, in terms of current books, relatively current books, I think I'd recommend three books: "The Unwinding" by George Packer, "Evicted" by Matthew Desmond, and "The New Jim Crow" by Michelle Alexander. And I think reading those books together, that trilogy, does a lot to explain how our country got to where it is today and why there's so much disappointment and hurt, why people are angry. In terms of podcasts, I like Pod Save America. They're super smart on politics, but they managed to find some humor, too, in the dark world we're living in.
All right. Well, thank you. Those are some great recommendations. And with that, we will close. Jeremy Hale, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today.
It was awesome being here. Thanks, Mike.
Thanks for listening to this Politics Guys interview. If you have any suggestions for future guests, or if you have any thoughts, questions, comments, or criticisms, we'd love to hear from you. Our email is mail@politicsguys.com. Our Facebook page, where we post throughout the week, is facebook.com/politicsguyspage. We're also on Twitter, @politicsguys. We'd really appreciate it if you could subscribe to the show and leave a review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast service you use. Sharing and retweeting our new show posts and tweets also helps out a lot. If you'd like to support the show financially, you can do that through the PayPal or Patreon links on our website. We especially appreciate those monthly sustaining contributions through Patreon. They really do help out a lot. If you enjoy the show, you should check out the Politics Guys weekly newsletter. You can take a look at previous newsletters and sign up to have it delivered to your email inbox on our website, politicsguys.com. We'll be back with a new show next Wednesday. We hope you join us.